Blog Talk Radio.
The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Written April 19th, 1860. First published in 1863 as part of Tales of a Wayside Inn. Listen, my children, and you shall hear of the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. On the 18th of April in 75, hardly a man is now alive who remembers that famous day and year. He said to his friend, "If the British march by land or sea from the town tonight, hang a lantern aloft in the belfry arch of the old North Church Tower as a signal light, one if by land and two if by sea, and I on the opposite shore will be ready to ride and spread the alarm through every Middlesex village and farm, for the country folk to be up and to arm." Then he said good night, and with muffled oar silently rowed to the Charleston shore. Just as the moon rose above the bay, where swinging wide at her moorings lay the Somerset, British man of war, a phantom ship with each mast and spar across the moon like a prison bar, and a huge black hulk that was magnified by its own reflection in the tide. Meanwhile, his friend, through alley and street, wanders and watches with eager ears, till in the silence around him he hears the muster of men at the barrack door, the sound of arms and the tramp of feet and the measured tread of the grenadiers marching down to their boots on the shore. Then he climbed the tower of the old North Church by the wooden stairs with stealthy tread to the belfry chamber overhead, and startled the pigeons from their perch on the somber rafters that round him made masses and moving shapes of shade, by the trembling ladder steep and tall to the highest window in the wall, where he paused to listen and look down a moment on the roofs of the town and the moonlit flowing over all. Beneath, in the churchyard, lay the dead, in their night encampment on the hill, wrapped in silence so deep and still that he could hear, like a sentinel's tread, the watchful night wind as it went, creeping along from tent to tent, and seeming to whisper, "All is well." A moment only he feels the spell, place and the hour, and the secret dread of the lonely belfry and the dead. For suddenly all his thoughts are bent on a shadowy something far away, where the river widens to meet the bay, a line of black that bends and floats on the rising tide like a bridge of boats. Meanwhile, impatient to mount and ride, booted and spurred with a heavy stride, on the opposite shore walked Paul Revere. Now he patted his horse's side. Now he gazed at the landscape far and near. Then, impetuous, stamped the earth and turned and tightened his saddle girth. But mostly he watched with eager search the belfry tower of the old North Church. As it rose above the graves on the hill, lonely and spectral and somber and still, and lo, as he looks on the belfry's height, a glimmer and then a gleam of light. He springs to the saddle, the bridle he turns, but lingers and gazes till full on his sight a second lamp in the belfry burns. A hurry of hoofs in a village street, a shape in the moonlight, a bulk in the dark, and beneath from the pebbles in passing a spark, struck out by a steed flying fearless and fleet, that was all, and yet, through the gloom and the light, the fate of a nation was riding that night. And the spark struck out that steed in his flight, kindled the land into flame with its heat. He has left the village and mounted the steep, and beneath him, tranquil, broad, and deep, is the mystic meeting the ocean tides, and under the alders that skirt its edge, now soft on the sand, now loud on the ledge, is heard the tramp of his steed as he rides. It was 12 by the village clock when he crossed the bridge into Medford town. He heard the crowing of the cock and the barking of the farmer's dog, and felt the damp of the river's fog that rises after the sun goes down. It was 1 by the village clock when he galloped into Lexington. He saw the gilded weathercock swim in the moonlight as he passed, and the meeting house windows black and bare gaze at him with a spectral glare, as if they already stood aghast at the bloody work. 2 by the village clock, when he came to the bridge in Concord town, he heard the bleating of the flock and the twitter of birds among the trees, and felt the breath of the morning breeze blowing over the meadow brown. And one was safe and asleep in his bed, who at the bridge would be the first to fall, who that day would be lying dead, pierced by a British musket ball. You know the rest. In the books you have read how the British regulars fired and fled, how the farmers gave them ball for ball from behind each fence and farmyard wall, chasing the redcoats down the lane, then crossing the fields to emerge again, under the trees at the turn of the road, and only pausing to fire and load. So through the night rode Paul Revere, and so through the night went his cry of alarm to every Middlesex village and farm, a cry of defiance and not of fear, a voice in the darkness, a knock at the door, and a word that shall echo forevermore. For, born on the night wind of the past, through all our history to the last, in the hour of darkness and peril and need, the people will waken and listen to hear the hurrying hoofbeats of that steed and the midnight message of Paul Revere. I wonder how many of you have actually heard that poem. I wonder how many of you have ever read that poem. I can't read these things without getting a little bit choked up. It's just, there's something about this country and the patriotism and the spirit that built it that causes me such disgust at what's going on right now, I can't tell you. Which is why I do this, which is why I read these poems, which is why I go back into our history, which is why I talk about the things that few others will talk about, which is why on July 4th, I'm going to read the Declaration of Independence in its entirety. And I get a little choked up with that too. Something about the words of being endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights that just inspires me. And so this is why I do this show. This is what this is all about. This is what this country is all about. This is what America is all about. It's the freedom. It's the independence. It's the liberty. It's the spirit. And I question where that spirit is. I know we have a massive problem with leftists in this country who want to destroy that spirit, who want to sort of fit us into this global world cog, system, who want to take everything that we have and everything that makes us special and get rid of it and merge us into the collective. It's like the Borg. You guys ever see the Borg? You guys know Star Trek? Okay. Not the good series, the one that was, fully patriotic and, full of individual rights and messages and things like that. The more collective, politically correct Star Trek. So the Borg was a collective, and they're saying is resistance is futile. And that's pretty much what the socialists are trying to say too. It's like, look, this is inevitable. That rights thing, well, that was nice a couple hundred years ago, but yeah, it really doesn't apply today. Constitution. Yeah, it's kind of outdated. We've got better things to do. We want to redefine rights as not the ability to defend yourself with musket and ball, or in this case, AR-15, a freedom rifle. It's more like, you have a right to health care and free college and free this and free that with a $22 trillion national debt. But I do ramble on. I'm not sure how long I'm going to have the show go today because Bill Barr, Attorney General, the new Attorney General, the real Attorney General, is going to be giving a press conference at 8:30. So it's about 7:08 here, my time, Central Time. So that'll be 8:30 Central Time for the press conference, 9:30 Eastern, 7:30 Mountain, 6:30 Pacific Time. I think it's going to be the best show in town. I just do. I think it's going to be an incredible thing to watch. Bill Barr he's the one that just, signed that order these illegal alien, asylum seekers can't, go into the country. They can't be caught and released. They have to stick around for their hearing. Now, what I would do, and one of the bills I'm going to be working on, is a national registry of illegal aliens that have not shown up for their hearing, and that has to be tied to IRS tax returns, to employment, to everything else. And then we got to find these people. And to the judges, say, look, you can't hear any more hearings until all your cases have cleared for the people that have escaped. And once they are, once these people have been found with any interaction with government, law enforcement, or something, somewhere along the way, it's like, okay, well, now that we have to seize everything that you have, and you're out of here. And the same thing with getting rid of, asset seizure from anybody that has an ITIN number, an independent tax identification number. That's the number used by illegal aliens in lieu of a social security number to which they're not entitled, but usually get with fraudulent ID. So there's a lot of work to do. But I wanted to talk about Patriots Day because we've lost our patriotism, except for those who fight for freedom. And I'm going to raise a little controversy here because this is something that's been bugging me for a long time. And I even heard a commercial on this, that if you listen to a lot of the general talk, the only way to serve your country is to serve in the military. That's the only fight for freedom. And that is an essential part of our freedom. Don't get me wrong. Without the military, we would have been invaded long ago. World War II would have turned out very differently if we didn't have a strong military. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is there are more ways to fight for freedom. You know, I kind of think of what I try and do here, you know, empowering citizens to be able to write their own legislation, something that's never been done in the history of this world, where any average person can write a law and that might become a law. You know, think about that for a second. You are empowered. You know, you always have been empowered. You're endowed by your creator with the ability to give your consent to be governed through writing the laws by which you are governed. And I am simply the messenger that is saying, yes, you can, and this is how it works, okay? And this is just one way of doing it. And there'll probably be other ways as people copy me and other things happen along the way. But for right now, I'm it. You know, as far as I know, it's the only radio show with its own citizen legislature. So think about that for a second. Think about what the founding fathers would think of using our technology today, you know, to spread the word and to allow anybody to call from anywhere to propose legislation here on this show that people anywhere in the country can comment on, can work on, can use at the local level, the city level, county level, state level, congressional level, the presidential level. This is the access that we have, and this is the chance to do it. And you better do it now, because, you know, if you do not act, you know, to fight for your country, for the freedom of your country, you know, plus the military, plus, you know, using the media, plus, you know, writing and teaching and talking and using social media and taking active parts in anything that has to do with freedom, whether it's going to the Laguna Beach City Council and making sure that the American flag, you know, is not considered too aggressive. What kind of idiots are these people? You know, you've got to stand up to this stuff. And the good thing is they're actually not that hard to defeat. I think people have been sort of cowed into not responding because they don't want to be labeled racist, or they don't want to be, you know, it's just they don't want to get involved. Okay. But once you do get involved, it's amazing what can happen. Brett Kavanaugh has his job because he fought back. President Trump is still in office because he fought back. You know, all the good things that are happening now are because people are fighting back against the socialist trend, and they're screaming and yelling. And of course, the more effective you are, because the more they're screaming and yelling. So the Mueller report, the greatest report on nothing in American history, is about to be issued, and it's going to be about an hour and 18 minutes. All right, and Bill Barr is going to talk about it, and I think it's going to be fascinating because I was listening to Giancova, I think his last name is. Anyways, last night on Fox News, I just caught a little bit of it, talking about the implication of Barack Obama in the entire FISA warrant, bogus spy scandal, Uranium One, everything else that's going on. And so this is where it's going to go. I mean, I talked about this a year ago, that this eventually is going to end up in Barack Obama's lap, that he had to have approved the sale of uranium, the bogus, you know, the money that, you know, was used to pay for the bogus you know, dossier that ended up as a bogus FISA warrant, which ended up as an excuse to spy on Trump. And this is what I got from Russia, because they wanted to say Russian collusion. See, this is where this dossier came from, right? See how this works? Okay. So you blame them, and then you have to investigate them. But it was always a coup d'etat, you know, amongst members of the FBI, that the hacks of the Obama administration, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. I mean, that's we know this is where it's going to go. Now, how exactly it's going to happen, we don't know. But I'm very, very curious to see what Bill Barr releases. And the media, it's going to be funny to watch them squirm. But that's what's happening. All right. So I want you to rediscover your roots. I want you to rediscover your patriotism. I want you to read to your kids The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. I want you to talk about what this is all about, how one person on horseback alerted a nation. Okay, that's what it takes. One person can take action. You know, I'm hoping that, you know, that Action Radio is considered kind of a Paul Revere of liberty today, that that through all the folks that participate in this, the callers, the researchers, the reporters, the folks that help us out, the people that post stories on Facebook that I get to use, you know, everybody out there that is connected in some way with trying to make this a better, freer country. We are messengers to more of you. And let's see what happens. Let's see what we can do. Got a little bit of time. We've got a few things going on today. We've got our Wendy Arthur's going to have the art report. That's going to be at 7:30 in about 15 minutes. We've got Michael Volpe with his investigative report. That's going to be fun, too. And so I'm going to let Michael go until about 8:30. And then at 8:30, I'll probably shut off the show because I really want to hear the William Barr Attorney General press conference. And the problem is, if I don't hear it, you know, firsthand, if it's some kind of, you know, chopped up highlights, you're going to miss all the nuances. You're going to miss the good stuff. The best stuff is what you hear the first time. All right. And I'm sure I'll get a YouTube of it and I'll be able to post that later. But I really want to hear it now so that when the spin comes in, I'll be able to talk a little bit about that. But I want to get you back to your patriotism. All right. And I want you to, in fact, if you go to my page, Action Radio with Greg Penglis, you'll see some of the things that have gone on. I even get into Waco. You know, Waco, the what I call the equivalent of the Boston Massacre by the British. All right. The difference is that we fought back against the British and nobody has done anything really seriously about Waco. The perpetrators are still out there. So let me tell you about Action Radio and I'll have more on the Battle of Lexington Concord and the shot heard around the world. This is Greg Penglis. So what is Action Radio? It is a radio show with its own citizen legislature. That's you, the listener. It is a fully interactive system of listeners, expert guests, social media, writing bills, legislator input, bill submission, lobbying, and citizen action. Action Radio is the future of talk radio using all the available technology in one completely integrated new system. Yep, that's what it is, and that's what we do here, and so we shall carry on. I found a great article from the History website, that would be history.com, talking about the Battle of Lexington Concord, all right? And the origin of the Battle of Lexington Concord really was gun control. And this is why I'm so against gun control and why I'm so shocked that the people of Massachusetts are so willing to do to their fellow citizens what we fought the British from doing, you know, back in 1776, which was, you know, confiscate firearms. And so that's what it was. There was the British marched on Lexington and Concord to basically steal the guns and the cannons and the powder and the shot, in other words, musket balls that that the Minutemen were gathering for possible war or conflict or whatever was going to happen, you know, against the British oppressors. And what's fascinating that's happened now is basically the Second Amendment in reverse. So in other words, the government has an uninfringed right to acquire anything they want. And the people are greatly stymied in what we can, you know, accumulate. And the problem is, if the Second Amendment were really enforced, you know, the people would have all the arms equal or superior to the government as a check on government power. Okay, and that's the way it's supposed to be. All right. And the problem is that there are laws all over this country right now that are oppressing the Second Amendment, and they get away with it because if you fight them, you know, the ultimate penalty is death by gunfire by government guns. Think about that. If you walk in certain places in California, say you walk downtown San Francisco openly carrying a firearm, right? So you're walking down Market Street, which is the biggest, you know, street in the city. You walk down Market Street in San Francisco openly carrying a gun and say, yeah, Second Amendment. You're wearing a big Second Amendment t-shirt, which actually is your right. That is a right that cannot be touched by government as expressed very clearly by the Second Amendment. All right. So you're walking down the street with your gun. The first thing that's going to happen within seconds is someone's going to call 911. Oh, no, there's a person openly carrying a firearm. Oh, no, call the police. And that's a problem, first of all, too, because the sight of firearms on civilians should be as normal as the sight of shirts and pants. I mean, that's what we want to get to. The sight of a firearm on a civilian, a non-government person, a non-law enforcement person should raise no more attention than the sight of shirts and pants. I mean, that's when you know the Second Amendment is in force, okay? The normalization of the sight of firearms, all right? We're not there. We're not even close. So anyway, let's continue our scenario. So you're walking down the street, right, with you openly carrying your gun. You're not doing anything. You have a holstered weapon that's loaded, of course, because what's the point of an unloaded weapon? You know, so you have a loaded weapon in a holster and walking down the street with a T-shirt that says, you know, I believe in the Second Amendment, all right? So the police are going to surround you with their guns drawn, and the SWAT teams are going to be called, and they're going to tell you to, you know, hit the deck, put your hands on your head, you know, carefully, you know, do whatever they want. And they're going to say, well, we're going to take your gun. And you say, excuse me, I'm not doing anything wrong. The Second Amendment says, you can't touch me. You can't touch me because the right to of the people to carry arms, you know, cannot be infringed, which means the absolute outside fringe of the right can't be touched. And you can say that as they're slamming you to the ground or shooting you with a beanbag or tasing you or whatever else. But ultimately, if you resist long enough, you're going to be shot and killed simply for exercising your Second Amendment right. And that is the Second Amendment in reverse. And that is the state where we are now. If you ultimately resist and proclaim your right and express your right, which you have every right to do, and the government cannot touch you until you touch your firearm for a purpose, you know, that is unlawful, brandishing, extortion, murder, things like that. But just the idea of just owning and carrying a firearm, keeping and bearing, is completely protected and the government can't touch you. So how do we get to a position where we actually are in a position where the government can't touch us? Well, we don't know. We don't want to fight a war, you know, but we have to fight a political war. And that's what we're doing here at Action Radio. Okay. We're fighting a political war. a war to restore the rights that this country originally talked about that you are supposed to have as a citizen, to give you your full citizenship, to actually have you be able to experience what it's like to live in a truly free country as designed by the founders. And one of the ways to get there, the way I'm going to do, the way I've decided on pursuing for the rest of my life, is that you, the citizen, take part in what I call, you know, the principle of action radio, where we, the people, give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed. Okay? Let's go back to the Battle of Lexington and Concord. History site, history.com. I want to tell you the origins of this just to let you know, where what people were willing to do then compared to what people are not willing to do now. So it says the Battle of Lexington Concord fought on April 19th, 1775. Okay, April 19th is Patriots Day, right? It should be a holiday every bit as big as July 4th. All right, that's something we should probably do too, is start a movement to make the initiation of our war for independence a holiday. So people think about it, learn about it, understand it. It's not. People talk about the Boston Marathon, the New York Marathon. You know, imagine that of terrorists bombing Boston, on a festival, the marathon, to celebrate our independence, our Patriots Day, our war against the British. Think about that for a second. All right. So the Battle of Lexington Concord fought on April 19th, 1775, which started April 18th with the ride of Paul Revere. This being April 18th, this being the day before I take off on vacation. I'm gone for a few days, so Bill Fetke is going to fill in for me. But back to that wasn't in the History Channel. That was just me. So April 18th, 1775, kicked off the American Revolutionary War. That's not what we weren't fighting a revolution. We were fighting a war for independence. So I got to correct when the history is wrong. I'll do that myself. Anyway, it says 1775 to 83. Tensions had been building for many years between residents of the 13 American colonies and the British authorities, particularly in Massachusetts. On the night of April 18th, 1775, hundreds of British troops marched from Boston to nearby Concord in order to seize an arms cache. In other words, a whole bunch of stored arms. In other words, gun control. Paul Revere and other riders sounded the alarm, and what they screamed, well, I think it's in the article, I'll save it for later. Anyway, sounded the alarm, and colonial militiamen, I don't like that term, militiamen, because you'll notice whenever the news media, the leftist media, is talking about independent freedom fighters in their country, they're called militiamen. Well, granted, our colonial folks, I prefer the term minutemen, okay, because they were able to go in a minute, to battle. These were farmers. These were, Cooper Smiths, look it up, and brewers and blacksmiths. And these are just regular people, all right, that had that musket nearby. And if they were called to fight, they were going to do it. It was a citizen army. It was a citizen militia. All right. Colonial militia, as they say, began mobilizing to intercept the Redcoat Column, in other words, the British. A confrontation on the Lexington Town Green started off the fighting, and soon the British were hastily retreating under intense fire. Many more battles followed, and in 1783, the colonists formally won their independence. Well, formally won our independence, actually. It's a little bit off. Anyway, I don't remember reading in this particular article, what the actual words were spoken by Captain John Parker, and I should go over that too, because I spent several years in Lexington growing up, and I've watched the reenactments, and I've seen some of the things we did the simulated Paul Revere ride, and hang on, I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I have to write a quick message to one of my folks, so what I'm gonna do is interrupt this just for a second, play you something, and get that taken care of, and then I'll be right back to you in just a bit. You are listening to Action Radio Online with Greg Penglis. The webpage for all Action Radio shows and podcasts is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Please share our show with all your friends and family, both nationally and internationally. The guiding principle of Action Radio is this: we the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed. Well done. So that's one of the things about being producer. There's a lot of things I have to do here. So I did one more thing. I'll take care of that in a little bit. Let's get back to our history. And it's quite fascinating how this works. All right. Anyway, so they're saying here, leading up to the Battle of Lexington Concord, starting in 1764, and here's where it gets interesting, Great Britain enacted a series of measures aimed at raising revenue from its 13 American colonies. What's the first thing the socialists are trying to do, by the way? Raising revenue? Okay, do you see the parallels here? There are reasons that I do what I do and what I say what I say. Okay. So, you know, and I'm drawing parallels all the time between the socialists of today and the monarchy of George III in the 1700s, because there's not a whole lot of difference. They both want the same thing, absolute power, right? Yeah, with them at the top. We will go on. Many of the measures, including the Sugar Act, the Stamp Act, the Townsend Acts, generated fierce resentment among the colonists, who protested against taxation without representation, okay, because the laws were made in Britain and they couldn't vote for the people that were taxing them, all right? And I'm taking that one step further, saying we're going to even write the laws by which we are governed, not just vote for the representatives who are writing the laws that govern us, all right? That's a huge difference. That's a monumental change in freedom. I want you to think about that too. Back to the article. Boston, the site of the 1770 Boston Massacre, which I have compared to the attack on Will by Clinton and Janet Reno. 1773, Boston Tea Party was one of the main points of resistance. Okay, this is a good resistance when you resist them. What the Democrats are doing is not resistance. It's resistance. Yeah. Anyway, King George III of Britain ramped up the military presence, and in June of 1774 shut down the city's harbor. That would be Boston. Until colonists paid for the tea dumped overboard the previous year. Oh, I like that. Yeah, if you're a little temper tantrum, we're going to make you pay for the tea. Okay, fine. So the British Parliament declared that Massachusetts was an open rebellion. Yeah, it's back when they actually fought for their freedom. I don't know what they're doing now. So here's another interesting thing, a little tidbit from the history.com website. Did you know Paul Revere never shouted the legendary phrase, "The British are coming"? You know, of course not. You know why? Because everybody in the country was still British. That's like right down the street. The Americans are coming. Oh, really? Yeah, well, we're all here, pal. What are you talking about? So he never said the British are coming. What he said was the regulars are coming. Okay. So the regulars, you know, when they talk about a well-regulated militia, that means a well-armed militia. That means basically regular army, infantry. So regulars are what you would call infantry today, soldiers armed with weapons they can carry in their arms, you know, rifles, you know, handguns, things like that. The Swiss arms, international arms, I forgot what it's called, but they have definitions. They kind of divide things up into small arms and light weapons. And so as I define the Second Amendment, small arms, you know, are the things like rifles, pistols, shotguns, you know, fully automatic weapons, things like that, stuff you can carry in your arms. All right. Light weapons, which I do not consider part of the Second Amendment, would be like mortars, bazookas, anti-tank, flame throwing, that thing, anything that requires a crew, anything that that requires a stationary thing, anything that you can't carry in your arms, okay? Because the Second Amendment clearly says the right of the people to bear arms, okay? Which means whatever it is you can carry in your arms, and that would include a 50 caliber, you know, long-range sniper rifle, okay? So all these things are arms, and some people disagree with me. They say, well, anything counts as arms. A tank counts as arms. Well, if you have to steal a tank because you're being invaded, that's, yeah, then certainly you can do that, but you can do that with regular arms, with rifles, shotguns, pistols, you know, scoped rifles, sniper rifles, 50 caliber, things like that. So pretty much anything up to 50 caliber, which is half an inch, you know, for a shell, you know, is what I would consider arms. And we can disagree with, we can agree or disagree about that, but that's kind of how it works. Anyway, and so people are saying, well, what do you want, a nuclear weapon? Is that the Second Amendment? Oh, don't be an idiot. This is a stupid thing that people say all the time. You know, and the other question that really cracks me up is, why do you need an assault weapon? Well, first of all, need has nothing to do with it. It may be or it may not. But, you know, if I want to get something, it may be because of need, maybe because of want, maybe because of anything. And the other question is, why do you need to know? You know, my freedom is not dependent on what you think I need. So there are many ways to answer that question. All right. So let's just go back to the article here. So he never said the British are coming. As Paul Revere passed from town to town during his midnight ride on April 18th, which is today, 1775, the operation was meant to be conducted as discreetly as possible, since scores of British troops were hiding out in the Massachusetts countryside. Furthermore, colonial Americans at the time still considered themselves British. So he never said the British are coming. He didn't scream. He's like, hey, guess what? You know, we got this column of soldiers, you know, moving up from Boston. All right. So let's hide the guns. Let's hide the shot, hide the powder, and let's get the hell out of Dodge. All right. Well, probably didn't say that because I don't think Dodge was even a city at that point. But you know what I mean, right? Back to the article. On April 18, 1775, Joseph Warren learned from a source inside the British High Command that redcoat troops – yeah, the British were stupid. They wore red. Now, I guess allegedly that's to, like, hide the blood in battle so no one knows you've been injured. But, eh, I'm not sure, you know, I'm not so sure about that. Anyway, so going on here, it says April 18, 1775, Joseph Warren learned from a source inside the British High Command that redcoat troops would march that night unconquered. Warren dispatched two couriers, silversmith Paul Revere. He was a silversmith. I think he was a brewer, too. Anyway, I know he's a silversmith. And tanner, William Dawes, to alert residents of the news. There were three people who rode that night. Paul Revere, I guess, you know, listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of William Dawes. Doesn't quite have the same ring to it as listen, my children, and you shall hear of the midnight ride of Paul Revere. So, Paul, you know, and Paul Revere being the rich guy in town, the silversmith, he gets all the notoriety. And so that's how that works. I'm going to bring on Wendy just to kind of listen for a second here. And I'm going to finish this paragraph and we'll get back to the art report for today. So he says they first traveled by different routes to Lexington, a few miles east of Concord, where revolutionary leaders, War for Independence leaders, Samuel Adams and John Hancock had temporarily holed up, having persuaded those two to flee because they were leaders of the upcoming war. A weary Revere and Dawes then set out again. On the road, they met a third rider, Samuel Prescott, who alone made it all the way to Concord. Revere was captured by British patrol, while Dawes was thrown from his horse and forced to proceed back to Lexington on foot. And that is the accurate historical account of what happened preceding the Battle of Lexington-Concord, which started our war for independence, that started on the night of April 18th, 1775, which is why I'm talking about it now, and everybody else in the news media is wasting their time on the Mueller report, the greatest report on nothing in the entire history of our country. On that note, good morning, Wendy.
Good morning, Greg.
You like how I segue into that?
That was just perfect. It was as smooth as glass.
So let's go from the War for Independence to the art report. So do you have any revolution? Hey, let's talk about revolutions in art. Has art caused revolutions? And can you think of art? This is my spontaneous brain at work here, right? Can you think of art? Go ahead. So art that caused revolutions, or art that inspired, or art that that carried people through, you know, times of crisis. Let's talk about that.
I think that's very true, because I don't know if it caused revolutions. I think is more like a historian of revolutions and what the people are feeling, and especially cartoonists. I mean, that's an art in itself. You know, the political cartoonists, I think they have captured revolutions and the ideas of in the heart of the people more than anything during tumultuous times. I mean, just that's my opinion. But yeah, I think art is a reflection of what everybody's feeling, not necessarily causing the revolution, but expressing the feelings of the people during it.
Well, that's interesting. There was a couple of things come to mind. One, the tapestry in I forgot that town in France depicting, you know what I'm talking about, that like 100-foot-long tapestry. Is it doing the Middle Ages or I forgot what it was. I know I saw it. I'm trying to think of what it is right now. But that was a whole depiction of history. It was like the entire historical record on a tapestry.
Pretty much. And, yeah.
you know what I'm talking about, right? I'll have to, I can look it up, if we.
Yeah, I don't remember the name of it, but it's very famous and it's you know huge. And it, and it's like almost like a timeline.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's bothering me now. I'll think of it. Yeah, it'll come to me at some point. Yeah, I'm having a junior moment or whatever. I don't consider senior moments because I'm not there yet. So this is a junior moment.
That's right.
But we'll get going. But we're going to ramble on today because this is going to be a little bit shorter. And like I say, you can stay as long as you want. And I know Michael's going to take some time. I want to break up the show a little early today because I want to watch the Bill Barr report. Basically, I want to see how they're going to go after the most corrupt president in our history, and see what happens with that. So you don't have to talk about that unless you want to, but this is why I have a little less time this morning, but we can still chat because I have art things that I think fascinate me, and I'll tell you what. So any comment on you don't get a chance to do this, but the current affairs of the day, so to speak?
It's the current affair, right now that everybody's talking about, of course, is the Notre Dame and all those pieces of art that were lost, and just treasures to the French people. Mm-hmm. And some things were saved, the cross that didn't burn and all that kind of stuff. And I don't know how you just can't replace the pieces of art that were lost. You can't. They were historical treasures in and of themselves, but they're talking about making it even better than before. So I don't know what art they're going to put in there now. Hmm. But with billions of dollars going in, they should be able to at least reconstruct the building, hopefully as close to the original as possible.
Well, I'm curious if they're going to use the same, wooden beams, because those beams were, huge. They don't have forests that big anymore. They don't have trees that big. And I certainly don't want them logging the California, I don't want them logging the California redwoods. You know, should probably be actually probably bigger than the French trees they use. Maybe there's some other building material they can use and kind of update, you know, using modern materials in an older style, like a special type of concrete or whatever. I'm not really concerned about the actual materials, but I'd love to see them rebuild it. And I don't know if we've, you know, churches themselves are works of art, you know, despite all the things that are in there. You know, I mean, where did that, do you know where the design came from? Because they're basically in the form of a cross. I don't know if they face certain ways, but Catholic churches especially, I mean, you've got where the altar is up front, and then you have like a cross, you have a left, right side, and then you have like the long length, and then the pipe organ is above that, and the doorway to come in. Do you know the origins of the reason for that? I'm sort of crossing over into your ministry knowledge at this point.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure, you know, where all the architectural designs came from, but you know, I know in the Byzantine period, so many churches were using that style. But as far as churches today aren't based on that, you know, the modern churches is, you know, basically, you know, it's like how many aisles, you know, they have several more aisles to get people in and out of just for safety reasons in case there is a fire and people are inside and, you know, that kind of thing. But the old Byzantine style where you have, you know, the big aisle in the middle and the like the cross shape like you were talking about across the front, you know, those are all beautiful. They're ornate. And you have to understand that when they were building these churches back then, you know, it was a very holy undertaking. It wasn't just, you know, let's build a building so that's big enough to hold people. This was a building that was supposed to be as glorious as it could be in honor of God, you know, to present, this is what we're presenting to you. And today it's much more functional. And I'm not saying that they haven't, you know, dedicated their sanctuaries and all that kind of stuff to the Lord. I'm sure they have, but it's just not, I don't think they have the same mindset as when they were building them back then.
Yeah. And it's interesting that, you know, whole requiems were written, like Mozart's Requiem, I think, you know, and so many of the classical music pieces were written as religious, as church, as, you know, for God and the glory, you know, of God. And it's fascinating to see how this all works, that a lot of our art, you know, a lot of our buildings, a lot of what people dedicated themselves to, and the church was like the focal point of a whole town. You know, in our foundings, especially, I mean, you know, church wasn't someplace you just went on Sunday, listened for an hour and a half, got bored and left, you know, or, you know, you actually, I mean, the church was where the meetings were. It's, I think the schools were there at some point, you know, everything that went on in the town kind of went to the church, didn't it? If I remember.
Well, they did. And all the plays were held at churches, all the, you know, all social functions were pretty much held at the churches. It was just like you said, it was the focal point of everybody's life. And that's why, you know, it so much importance was put on the building and to make it as beautiful as possible.
Yeah. There's another place that was the focal point of the town too. You know what I'm thinking of?
Well,
the pub.
Public
house.
The pub and the brothels were also very, very.
Well, I don't think, now the pub, I actually have a reason for it. The brothels was something else. You know, that was what they were. You know, we know what brothels are. Okay, fine, we don't have to get into that.
Right.
But the point is the pub, and because a lot of people have told me that what we do here at Action Radio, the idea of a citizen legislature, of going over bills that we consent to be governed by and laws that we consent to be governed by, is very similar to what went on during our war for independence, during our times when we were breaking from England, when people would gather in pubs and do exactly what we're doing now. So this is kind of like a pub of the air, you know, except that we're ranging across the whole country. We have anybody that can call in at 215-383-3832 or internationally 011, then 1, then 215-383-3832. I'm going to remember my number. Well, I got them written here. But I'm just anyway. But we have Denmark, by the way, too. We have listeners in Denmark who have now joined us.
Yay.
So we have 21 countries.
Welcome,
yeah.
Denmark.
Yeah, exactly. And part of what I think this will be very interesting today, especially for our international listeners, is that the freedom that this country represents, I think, has been lost. You know, and if we lose it, then they're going to lose it. You know, a lot of the world looks to us as a beacon of freedom. And if we can't maintain it, how is anybody else supposed to do it? You know, this is our job
You're
as Americans.
Right about that.
Yeah.
You're right about
that.
And yeah. There's freedom is a two-edged sword, you know, that there's a lot of responsibility that comes from freedom, and people want the freedom, but they don't want the responsibility that goes with it.
I think you've differentiated freedom from liberty. Okay. Because we talk about freedom and liberty. Liberty is like freedom with responsibility. Does that make sense?
Well, yes, you're right about that. I just, I don't like to see people overstep the freedom thing by saying, well, I can do whatever I want. Well, no, that's not freedom.
Yeah.
You can do what you want, and until it's going to harm somebody else, you can't do that. You know, and that's not okay.
Yeah.
and
that makes
do
perfect sense.
Want, even though it harms somebody else, and call it freedom, that's not correct. So.
Right. Yeah, and that's why we have laws. You know, and the ancient Greeks discovered that 100% freedom or complete anarchy does not make you free.
It puts you
in a position. No, you're not free because, you know, if everybody is free to make up whatever they want to do, then you're constantly guarding your property. You're guarding your family. You know, you can't be productive. You can't start a business. You can't do anything else because you never know who's going to steal something from you because everybody and everything's free. There are no laws. I mean, that's not freedom. Freedom is defined by certain laws, you know, that allow us to be free and everything else, to engage in business and commerce and art and everything else that we do to build a society and build a, you know, better place for ourselves. But for some reason, there's always a certain percentage of people that say, well, I want more control over other people. Those are the folks who should be automatically disqualified for office. That's where we run into problems.
Yeah.
That's where the leftism, socialism, communism, and all these folks say, once you cross that line from, I want to be free to do what I want and you can do what you want, and that's okay. You know, I'm not going to impinge on your freedom. You're not going to impinge on mine. That's okay. But once you cross that line into, I want to control what you want to do because my beliefs are not only good for me, but they're good for you too. That's when we seem to lose it.
You're right. Because anarchy drives people apart.
Mm-hmm.
There's no way that you can unite under anarchy because it's all about a very, very selfish point of view.
Right.
And, you know, where freedom actually unites people. Because you're working for the common good, for everybody's good, where anarchy is just like, hey, it's all about me.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting, I was just thinking of the difference between art in socialist countries, where it's designed to glorify the government, and art in free societies, which is designed to glorify the human spirit, or God, or any number of other things. What do you think of that?
Well, and you're very true, because I don't know if you remember... we did a show about a fellow who does masonry, stonemasonry work.
Right.
And he's from Iran. He lives in Australia now.
But, yeah, I remember that.
He said he was so glad to leave Iran because it was so oppressive. The government would tell him what he could and could not create. And being here in America, we just would never put up with that. What are you talking about that I telling me that I can't, you know, express myself through my art? I'm an artist. This is what we do. And it was, no, we want you to do this and we want you to do it this way. And this better be the result of it. There's no freedom in that. There's no way to express yourself in that.
Yeah, I'm curious what happens if we follow, you know, the socialists and the Green New Deal to their ultimate extreme, would they then want to do for art and the humanities, the endowments, what they want to do for national health care, in other words, a government system, would we have, as those other countries have, government art? In other words, if the government didn't want to sponsor it, would you be allowed to do it?
That's a good question. I think government would only sanction, and that's a good word for that, they would only sanction art that promoted their current agenda.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'd be very curious about that.
Or it would have to be abstract art because, you know, that can be interpreted any way you want it to be interpreted, you know, kind of thing. That's what they would tell you. There would be nothing concrete that definitive unless it supported their current agenda.
It's fun to kind of explore these and kind of brainstorm every once in a while because it sets up all the other shows. I'd be curious if you ever want to do a show on revolutionary art or art that inspired or art that, you know, there was a saying, art upsets, science reassures. So art is designed to cause controversy. And sometimes it's caused too much controversy. There's some art that's just disgusting. I wouldn't stop it because I want people to see what, you know, even if it is disgusting, it's still a point of view. And you should, you know, be disgusted by certain things. And that shows you have a value system. But
right.
You know, but certain things are funny. They're kind of crazy. I want to bring up one thing. Michael's on the line, too. I don't know how long you want to hang on this morning. Hang on for a few minutes. Yeah, we'll do a few minutes more. We can do stuff. But be interesting, actually, to get you two together. Michael's got an incredible report today, and I'm going to give him probably about, you know 40, 45 minutes before we get the bar thing. But there was Picasso, one of my favorite artists. He painted a picture called Guernica. And Guernica was a town in Spain that was bombed by basically the Nazis who were backing Franco. And it was one of these absolutely unnecessary bombings of a civilian town. It wasn't really a military target. There's no reason to do it. They totally devastated this place. But this incredible painting that's still very famous to this day called Guernica. And I want to get a picture of it. I'm going to get a print of that and put it up in my place here in the great studio of Action Radio. But are you familiar with that? In fact, Michael's on the line now. Are you familiar with that painting at all?
Wendy? Are you talking to me or Mike? Oh, me.
Well, Mike's on. Well, I like to bring people on to listen to kind of get them in the groove of what's going on before they have
right.
to say anything. Michael, sure, go ahead. Michael's our investigative reporter, family law person. So there we go, just to introduce everybody.
Right. Wendy.
Yeah, Michael Volpe.
Wendy said she knew an artist from Iran and the state constricted him. And here in America, we would never stand for that. And we can't imagine the government constricting our art. Is that basically what you said? Yeah. Yeah. Tell that to Lenny Bruce. You don't think the government constricts your art? Go look up Lenny Bruce. Go look up the Hays Code. That constricted Hollywood for years and years. You know, there was only certain ways you could end movies, or you know, you could screen them at like four theaters.
That's interesting.
We do constrict art in America, and it's freer than Iran. But don't think for one second that you can paint what you want, you can say what you want. Lenny Bruce went to jail because he was swearing. We absolutely do constrict art, and we got a history of hundreds of years of laws and other actions taken that constrict it.
Yeah, the Hollywood 10, the whole blacklist, the House Un-American Activities
mm-hmm.
Committee.
Absolutely.
Trumbo. Yeah. Did you ever see that movie I think I forgot the guy,
yeah.
Cranston?
It's not,
did,
it's not 100% accurate, but yeah, basically for your thoughts and opinions, there's I'm not going to remember the guy's name, but he played Fred Friendly. I think that not Fred Friendly. He played the main gangster on the Waterfront, and he was targeted, and he described that you're followed. You can't work. You can't do this. You can't do that. And you, at some point, you just say, what's the point? Why am I doing all of this? Absolutely, they were constricted.
Marlon Brando
Rod Steiger?
No, he
was called a character actor. I'm not going to remember the guy's name, but he played the
Broderick
main
Crawford?
Gangster.
Broderick Crawford?
No.
Okay,
if
we'll
you
think
say
about
it,
anyway.
I'll remember it. But he played the main gangster on the Waterfront. He was in 12 Angry Men and a bunch of other things. But he got caught up in the communist scandal, and he stopped working for a few years.
Lee J. Cobb?
He described it was horrible. It was horrible. He was followed constantly. He couldn't work. Friends left him. It was basically this miserable, isolated life that was created by the government.
Was it Lee J.
Cobb? Marlon Brando?
You guys are really want to know the name of the actor. I'll look it up.
Like I said,
he played, I can't remember the character's name, but he played the main gangster on the Waterfront. Among other things.
You know, it's interesting, too, that move. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Lee J. Cobb.
Yeah, see, I had it right. So there.
Well, you did say it? Okay, I'm sorry.
I did say it.
Yeah, Lee J.
Don't
Cobb.
Don't worry about it. We're kind of free-for-all here. So just to let everybody know what's going on, we've got Wendy Arthur, who is our art reporter and also does the Oh My God report on Fridays. I got Michael Volpe, investigative reporter, author, and pretty much head of our family law project. And so we're kind of having a free-for-all discussion today, which is kind of cool. I want to kind of bring both of you in before Michael gets started, which I'll do in a couple of minutes. The fact that this is the eve of Patriots Day, the day that our war for independence started, and nobody's saying a word about it. And I'm rather disgusted, and that's why I read you know, the entire Paul Revere's Ride by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Any reaction to that? Speaking of poetry and our spirit of independence.
Right. Paul Revere, one of the earliest whistleblowers, many whistleblowers believe. I guess Independence Day is when we celebrate it, so it's like, you know, not having a second holiday. We take Independence Day pretty seriously. So if you're asking me, you're upset that no one, that this day has sort of been forgotten in history? Okay, yeah, that's probably true. It has. The country as a whole really doesn't understand the history behind the Revolutionary War and the things that were being basically argued with guns.
Well, I posted a lot of it, and I talked about the first half hour. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, right.
I want to get Wendy's take on this, too. Wendy, what do you think?
I missed the very first part of the show, but I came in on the last, segment of the first half hour. And I agree that there's just so much that has been changed. I don't think that everything that is presented today actually happened the way that they say it did. And I think there's probably a lot of mysteries myself, because they're not going to tell you about all the covert stuff that was done. You know, that we just see the final result of so many things. And if you can express that and find out things about history and express it through any kind of, whether it's poetry or essay writing or movies or art or whatever you want to express it at, or even radio shows, there's just so many things that you can express. And there's so many things that come to light later that we didn't know. And like I'm... And I don't like finding out that, Columbus, everything that we were taught in school about Columbus isn't true.
Unless what you're taught now isn't true.
America,
but what if what's being taught now isn't true and it's revisionist history? That's another problem.
Well, and that's very true. Yeah, there is revisionist history all over the place and has been since the 70s. So, or maybe even before that, but I just want to know the truth, good, bad, or ugly. I just want to know the truth.
Okay.
I'm
going to let you go now and let Michael do his report. Now, tomorrow I'm not going to be here. I'm on vacation for a few days. And so Bill Fackty is going to take over, and he's only on until 8 o'clock. So we can't have one of our extended discussions where you never quite know when it's going to end because we just keep thinking of interesting things to talk about. So anything in conclusion, Wendy, or should we do it again next week for you and me?
We'll just do this next week. And Bill, it was great to have you on there this morning and have your point of view, because you had some really good points to make, and I appreciate that. And I just wanted to tell all of our listeners, thanks for joining in on our little chaotic talk this morning. And this is Wendy Arthur with the Art Report on Action Radio, coming to you from the Mississippi Gulf Coast with news you can use, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks, Wendy. Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
Thank you.
And actually, it's Michael. 30. Bill wasn't on. Bill's going to be on tomorrow. Michael Volpe's on with us right now. So go ahead, Michael.
Right. That's okay. Hey, Greg, I thought of like a 30-second rant. Can I just give it really quickly?
Well, it's you and me for the rest of the show. So we'll do it till 8:30, and then I want to listen to the Bill Barr press conference. Go ahead.
Before I get into my thing, I want everyone to understand, without Lenny Bruce, there is no Richard Pryor, there is no Eddie Murphy, there is no Chris Rock. He was the first guy... the first comedian to use, salty language. And it was a lot more than salty, but, he was the first one to use it effectively to make a career out of it. And the government hassled him from coast to coast. They put him in jail. They did everything they could to get him to stop swearing. And he smoked like a chimney, so I'm not going to say that his death, he had nothing to do with his death, but absolutely everything the government did, he died really young, I think around 50.
Wow.
And like I said, he was not a healthy guy. So he absolutely is responsible for 95% of his death. But to say that we do not constrict our artists is just, you go look up Lenny Bruce, and that is not accurate. He's one of do you consider comedians an art? And it is.
Well, I was
going to
say, you raise a fascinating point.
One of the greatest artists.
Yeah, I think like George Carlin, brilliant. I consider speech an art. an art form. Mm-hmm. I'm sort of trying, you know, I think our rant sometimes, you know, if we get really good at it, we'll take on the characteristic of art. So I got a caller right now, so I'm going to take our caller. I know you have an entire presentation.
Right.
Let's see who's on the line here. So our new caller who just joined us about a minute ago. Go ahead. This is Greg Penglis, Action Radio, and we have Michael Volpe, investigative reporter, author, and family law person extraordinaire. Go ahead. 251 area code. That's you. They left. Oh, come on.
They left. Shy. All right. That would have been cool. I don't know what to. All right. So start my report? In the spirit of art, I wanted to start my report with what's an urban legend about the movie Touch of Evil. So, and when I say urban legend, there are two stories about how it was made. This is one of them. So you could call it an urban legend or it has a 50-50 chance of being right. So it's made by a guy named Orson Welles, who also made the movie Citizen Kane, which is still considered either the best movie or on any short list of all time.
Yeah.
He made Citizen Kane when he was 24. By the time he was pushing 40, he was considered a washed-up has-been, a problem. You didn't want to work with him. He didn't go along. He just had a horrible reputation. So he was working. He had worked with this guy Al Sucksmith, who was he was called the King of the Bees. He was a producer of B movies, and he was trying to get a movie done. He wanted to work with this guy, and the story goes that Sucksmith says, "Well, you know, what do you want to make?" And there was a pile of scripts on Sucksmith's desk. So he said, "Well, you know what? You picked the worst script, and that's how good I am. I'll make that into the best movie." And it was a script based on like this dime store pulp novel called Badge of Evil, you know, where there's murder, and those were a dime a dozen, those kinds of novels. And that turned into Touch of Evil, if that's the true story, which is considered a classic today. However, the studio, once again, they recut a bunch of stuff that he didn't want, and it bombed at the time, though eventually the movie was made the way he wanted, and that's considered a classic. But so my report today is, in a sense, an homage to Orson Welles. So he took the worst script and tried to make it into a great movie. So what I'm going to try to do is take the driest, most dull-sounding topic and try to make that into an interesting segment. So what we're going to talk about today is shareholder meetings and proxy, and boy, does that sound just completely and totally uninteresting. So, okay. So
I was cracking up when I was reading this. This is amazing. Right. Anyway, go ahead.
Right. This is based on a hearing held in the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee. It's called the Application of Environmental, Social, and Governance Principles in Investing and the Role of Asset Managers, Proxy Advisors, and Other Intermediaries. And I did the thing on spoofing, and I forgot to mention, these are also based on articles I wrote both of them are for a website called The Industry Spread. So that's investing, trading, security stuff. So if you're interested in that, it's theindustryspread.com.
But, yeah, I'll post that article to our site,
Okay, so for those who don't so let's start with shareholder meetings. So what we're talking about is what's called a publicly traded company, something like Apple. But there are much smaller companies around than Apple, which are also considered publicly traded. Publicly traded means your company is on an exchange. And if you own shares in Apple, you are a part owner of Apple. Any share you own in any company, you are a part owner. However, in publicly traded companies, you are generally considered a passive owner, unless, of course, you have enough shares to do anything with. So shareholder meetings, which generally happen once a year, are the one and only opportunity for the actual owners of the company to get their say. So the easiest way, if it's really true that almost everyone has seen the movie Wall Street, then if you remember when the greed is good speech was at a shareholder meeting. In fact, if you remember when Gecko grabs the mic, he said, I want to thank the CEO for allowing me, as the largest shareholder, a chance to speak, which was the joke that you guys don't even know. And remember, in the speech, he says, you own the company, looking at the actual share. And the people sitting in the audience were all shareholders. You own the company, not them. And, you know, he was making the point that they're the CEO and all of these vice presidents own less. They don't actually have any shares in the company they're running. But that was a shareholder meeting, and what Gecko was doing was using the shareholder meeting as part of a larger strategy to try to take over the company. Mm-hmm. The one thing that people need to understand about shareholder voting and all of that is it's not one man, one vote. If you have a little stock of Facebook, your vote is not equivalent to Mark Zuckerberg's. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg may have enough shares to where his vote is the only vote that matters.
Yeah. It's not a democracy.
That's one, right.
Which is okay,
because
the country isn't a democracy either. So, yeah.
Right. It's a democracy. It's a finance democracy. You can have as much influence in Facebook as Mark Zuckerberg if you have enough money to buy enough shares.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah, but didn't he accumulate shares when the business grew? In other words, he had however many shares he had initially, you know, whatever the initial public offering was. All right, so this is how these things get going. Actually, they have private shares. You can buy private shares in a company, and then when they want to go public, they offer it to anybody to buy. But he still retains, you know, the majority shares. And then I don't know how they design it to do that, but his percentage doesn't change. How does it work?
It probably does change. Anytime you go public, you're giving up some of it, but
okay.
It's for the benefit financially to you is always overwhelming. And also keep in mind that Peter Thiel, the Trump supporter, he was the very first investor in Facebook at half a million, which is worth close to $1 billion now. How about that for an investment? You want to criticize Peter Thiel, just keep in mind that he is the first person to give Facebook any money. So in any case, what this particular hearing was about was the changing face of these shareholder votes, and also how powerful special interests are using the rules of shareholders to try to push social agendas.
Ah, and this is all in a committee hearing, right? You're talking about initially with the Senate committee hearing?
Correct.
Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs. Right, okay.
Right. In fact, a lot of it was written, I want to make sure I get the guy's name right, but last name is Copeland, James Copeland, who was a senior fellow and director of legal policy at the Manhattan Institute. He was one of the three people testifying. Now, another guy who testified is Phil Graham, and he actually had testimony that you would find interesting. So
Senator Phil Graham?
Former senator who chaired this banking, they call it, for short, they just call it the banking committee, but he used to chair this particular committee. So he made the point that the Enlightenment, which started in the 1700s, was driven by society's embrace of capitalism over socialism. And so let me get a couple of the quotes that he made. The Enlightenment was based on the principle that people own the rights to their work. So now here's another important quote, not on the Enlightenment, but he said, I believe that how corporate governance is structured and who money works for will have a profound effect on our future prosperity. So what he believes, number one, is that this fight, the shareholder fight, is a part of a bigger fight between socialism and communism. So he believes that these shareholder votes are being collectivized through a number of different dynamics. The first one is the growth of what are called index funds. Okay, so the very first index fund was done by a company called Vanguard. So with an index fund, let's
yeah, explain what it is to people.
Fund, right. So let's say you have an S&P 500 index fund.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get, so let's say the S&P 500 increases 13% this year. You won't get 13% because you have to pay a fee to the fund. But the fund tracks, minus the fee, exactly what happens in the S&P 500. Now, how do they do that? They buy an equal amount of shares in each of the 500 companies. And then the more money they get, the more shares they're buying. So they keep buying these shares. And then they charge a fee. And so these index funds, and there's probably a Dow Jones fund, there's tons of indexes, and there's tons of index funds. So this is from Graham's testimony. Today, index funds hold 17.2% of all U.S. shares and are the largest shareholder in 40% of all U.S. companies. So what happens with an index fund is you're not, like, thinking about one company over another. You've got an index. All you're doing is trying to manage the cost. Yet the funds are the single biggest shareholder in 40% of all U.S. companies. They hold 17.2% of all U.S. shares. So, and that's the shareholder votes go through them. That's what he means by collectivize. But there's
okay.
It's more complex than that. There's also institutional investors, companies like BlackRock, which you may or may not have heard of. But
I've heard Bain
of
Capital. you know that
or
one?
Bain
Romney's
Capital,
company?
But,
yeah.
But Bain is small fry. They're BlackRock. They're wealth managers, money
okay.
managers. These people have tons and tons of money. So they own lots and lots of shares. So what's happening is, some of these money managers have decided that there is their responsibility through as shareholders to address social issues. Secondly,
let's get some of these social issues out. I know where you're going, and I want to get there. Mm-hmm. I want to get there. We're gonna do it a little faster.
Okay.
And so I'm thinking, let's identify, you know, how corporations and socialism are kind of merging together in these stockholder-shareholder meetings.
Okay.
So tie up some loose ends here. Tell me where we are.
Okay, so let's
please.
Talk about the Fink letter. What is the Fink letter? That is Lawrence Fink, the chief executive officer of BlackRock. So I'm going to read from the report made by this guy Copeland. Yet the law has little say about how such institutional investors exercise their voting right as shareholders. In a winter 2018 letter to shareholders, BlackRock chief executive officer Lawrence Fink suggested a social purpose for corporations benefiting all stakeholders, not merely corporate shareholders. Here's from the letter. Society is demanding that companies, both public and private, serve a social purpose. So let me keep going. To prosper.
No, I'm reading the rest of it. I got it right here. It's fascinating. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, every company must not only deliver financial performance, but also show how it makes a positive contribution to society. So companies must benefit all of their stakeholders, including shareholders, employees, customers, and the community in which they operate, it's not exactly how a capitalist is supposed to think.
Have you heard the green investing?
That if you're a shareholder, your one and only responsibility is to the shareholders,
okay.
Not he's essentially saying, in order to have that responsibility, you should look at all these other people. That's a very dangerous thing to hear, because BlackRock own shares in lots and lots of companies. The second issue is there's a rule where you only have to own $2,000 or more of any given company in order to be able to submit a shareholder proposal. So what's happening? PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, is buying up small blocks of a lot of companies, going to their shareholder meetings, and placing proposals. Now, they get voted down, but they still have to be dealt with. And then placing proposals on during the shareholder meeting and having them voted on, and that's part of a larger campaign strategy or trying to get publicity, and then they get stories out based on that. And yeah. Copeland called these people gadfly shareholders, that they use this strategy that you only have to have 2,000 or more. And there was
actually, I got a question for you. I want to kind of leap in a little bit and sort of are shareholder meetings private or public? In other words, can anybody go to these, or do they only have to allow shareholders? Okay. So here's what I'm thinking. Here's where I think we're going. I want to kind of leap into this a little bit because there's some great issues here that I want to get to. The whole green movement, the whole idea of green investing, of things like Solyndra, of this idea that, you have to be a socially responsible investor. And that goes everything from sustainable crops in different countries and industries. You know, it's basically socialism dictating to capitalism how they're going to spend their money. And I think you've hit upon a fascinating topic here, but I want to get into some of the things that they're doing. And and I'm wondering if the Green New Deal ties into this, because socialism wants everybody's money. Not only do they, ultimately socialism controls the means of production. So if they're going to control the means of production, they're going to control the means by which things are produced, which is the money. So ultimately, here's the big question: is the socialist Green New Deal going to want to deal with our stock market and our companies and tell them exactly how to run them, or are they going to take them over entirely to promote, this wonderful utopian world that they want to do? And the shareholders won't be shareholders anymore; they'll just be, I don't know, like bank deposit holders. Where do you think we're going with the social justice? The for the benefit of society as opposed to the benefit of the corporation? Where do you think we're going with all this?
Right. I don't know the future, so I have no idea, and I don't think we're going to either place. I don't know. As far as the shareholder meetings, as I said, these activists use rules where you have to own very little. Let me give you from the paper. For example, when McDonald's shareholders gathered for the company's annual meeting in 2017, they had to vote on 7 shareholder proposals. Among these were a proposal against the company's use of antibiotics in its meat supply, brought by the Benedictine Sisters of Bourne, Texas, and one by the nonprofit Holy Land Principles, which wanted the company to modify its employment practices in Israel. The Bourne Sisters owned 52 McDonald's shares. The Holy Land Group owned 47. No shareholder sponsoring a proposal at the company's annual meeting that year owned more than 0.0001% of the company's stock. So what's happening is people who their owners in name only, if you own 0.0001 of the company's stock, you're not really an owner.
Well, if you have one share, though, what they're saying is you have one share, you're entitled to have your voice heard, which is kind of interesting when you think about it.
Right. Well, because it's 2,000 or more is the rule. So here's how PETA did it. Historically, here we go. In March, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals announced it was acquiring shares in Levi's in order to propose shareholder resolutions involving the manufacturer's use of leather patches. So they use this rule to go around and put these shareholder proposals together, which are usually voted down. But then PETA can use that for publicity. Another issue is what's called proxy advisory firms. So there are only 2 of these firms, and what they do is they advise places like index funds, which have tons of shares of lots of different companies, because you don't have time to look at every single shareholder proposal. And it's one thing that's interesting is one of the one of the people who testified. Let me make sure I get his name right.
Yeah.
His name is John Stroyer. John Stroyer, S-T-R-E-U-R. Hold on, I'm going somewhere. He's with
Well,
Calvert
the problem
Research
is we're getting too much detail, and I want to get to the story. And if we can, you know, give some sources for people to take a look at, I want to take a few minutes to get people ready for the Bill Barr, you know, press conference is coming up in just a few minutes. So I want to get back to Touch of Evil and how this all relates. And so if you can just tie it all together in the next couple of minutes, that'd
well,
be great.
The way it relates to Touch of Evil is I was trying to make this sound interesting. But what Stroyer said is his company voted on 4,700 shareholder proposals in the last year. So that's the reason that they need these proxy advisory firms, because they couldn't possibly go through them all at once. But what happens is a lot of these proxy advisory firms, what they have like basically left-wingers on who use their position to try to advance social policy. So let me read about one of these.
Well, say I gotta hang on. I think I got a call. I think it's Bill actually. So let's let him join our conversation. Go ahead.
No, this is Dave Schneier.
Oh, Dave, I'm sorry, Dave. Let's get you in on this. What do you think? What do you think about what we're talking about here?
Well, I heard some of it about like very small percentage of the shareholders in McDonald's being able to propose stuff that the company has to vote on, as far as my understanding.
Uh-huh.
One of the things about antibiotics, and I guess if I don't know. Me personally, I'm against using antibiotics. I don't know if that's really something the government needs to really, as long as it isn't like directly harmful for humans, meaning that we have tobacco and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that causes cancer. We don't have the government regulating that. So.
Okay. So what I want to do is, I think, like I say, we've got a lot of details. I want to kind of tie them in all together here and see if we can focus a little bit. So Michael, tell us where we're going and what's
all right. Let me read one last thing, and then I'll tie it all together. These in-house positions are often staffed by former employees of proxy advisors, thus sharing their proxy advisor biases, or otherwise at least somewhat committed to environmental or social investing causes. State Street, the world's third largest institutional investor, delegates oversight of these issues to Rocky Kumar, head of ESG investment and asset stewardship. Ms. Kumar has no apparent experience in trading in securities, but she envisions for herself a broad role in overseeing aspects of corporate management, both broad and granular. What's happening in our publicly traded company market is that it's being being dominated by both index funds and institutional investors. And both of those
entities.
Doing? Hold on.
I got to move on, Michael. I've only got, I want to tie this up.
All right.
We're getting lost in the details.
We're not getting lost in the details. Both of those entities farm out the decision of shareholder proposals to third parties. These third parties believe that they have a role in making social policy through the use of these shareholder proposals, and that's the issue that we have.
Okay. So our interest groups, special interest groups like PETA, like any of the many groups out there, you know, the green folks, the social justice warriors, are they using shareholder meetings to basically run company policy as kind of like and this is sort of off the radar screen. People aren't really watching what's going on with this. Is this kind of just one more way for people to sort of take away the free market and impose their will upon companies to do what they want rather than what the company wants?
Yes, so they can't impose their will, but correct. As I said, PETA, what they do is they buy enough shares in certain companies and then bring the shareholder proposals. They're always voted down, but they are then using that as a way to create more publicity for themselves, and not just PETA. And they're called gadfly shareholders, or this guy Copeland called them gadfly shareholders, people who buy just enough to be able to go to a shareholder meeting and bring forward these social proposals to be voted on.
Okay. Let me get Dave here real quick and see. Do you have a question on this issue, Dave?
Well, I guess so. They're doing it for social change. A lot of meat, I don't mind. Like, so the antibiotics in the meat. I don't. As far as my understanding, that's not like humans don't need that to be in their food. So if someone wants to buy some stocks and then propose that that won't be put in the food, I don't mind that. My thing is that the government's going to come around saying what can and can't happen. That's, to me, is the problem. Like, if companies want to make their own food good for you, I could care less. I mean, thank you. About the antibiotics or, I mean, stuff like that.
Yeah, that's one particular issue. Yeah, I think we're all kind of getting off track here today. I'll tell you what. Michael, why don't you sum it up? I'm going to let you go and talk to Dave for a minute, and I'm going to get into some quick stories here before we get to the press conference. So I'll give you the last word,
well,
Michael, for you.
Right. As I said, to sum it up, shareholder meetings are turning into another tool of activism for a number of that market dynamic reasons, like shares being taken over by index funds and wealth managers. And so it's something to watch, because these shareholder meetings will then become the next battleground for debates over guns, climate change, and these other things, and nobody will even know what's happening.
Yeah, that actually is really interesting, because I know companies like or organizations like Jesse Jackson's Push and various groups have tried to pressure companies. They do it through boycotting. They do it through getting rid of sponsors, like Fox News has lost sponsors when a host gets too controversial. There's all kinds of ways that people are trying to influence companies, influence capitalism, and you know, get around our free market and not have companies do what they want to do best. You know, which is make money, make products, make goods and services that people want, and we're getting away from that, which is really crazy. So that's good to know. All right, sir, let me let you go on that point. I'm going to talk to Dave for a little bit, and then we're going to get into the. I'm going to actually be, like I say, stopping in a few minutes, and I want to hear the Bill Barr pressing. So let me see. So there we go. So Michael's dropped off. Michael, thank you very much. Michael's the best. I mean, he really is. He's just got some incredible details to his reports. And so this is something he's basically started what could be, you know, a series of things we're going to talk about, you know, as things go with corporations. But did you hear the beginning of the show when I read the Midnight Ride of Paul Revere? And what do you think is happening?
No,
You missed that. Oh, well, you got to listen to the podcast.
Yeah.
Okay. So Patriots Day, we don't celebrate Patriots Day anymore. Do you talk about that? Think about that, you know, reflect on our war for independence and our founding in that respect on this day, on these days, April 18th and April 19th.
No, I didn't really. I don't. That's whenever the Paul Revere did the ride. So. Yeah. So no, I didn't know that was the date, actually.
That's fascinating, and that's also the scariest
thing
I've heard
today. They don't teach that in schools.
Why don't they teach that in schools?
They did, because I always took up all the history that they teach. So if I didn't
look
that up, then.
So just to let you know, Dave's one of our younger callers here, and so I'm always curious as to what's going on in the schools. They're not talking about that. That is insane.
They teach us that Paul Revere did his ride, but they don't tell us the date, no.
Do they teach you why he did the ride?
Yeah, to warn the Minutemen that the British were coming.
And what was the point of that? I want to test what they're teaching.
British
I'm not putting you on.
Well, it was actually so the British couldn't go to Concord and take the guns.
There we go. Okay, so you know that. I'm wondering how many young folks know that. That's what I'm asking you. That's what I'm curious about. Should be interesting. What do you think of Notre Dame? Terrorist or accident?
Well, so far that we know is accident. Anything is really possible these days. But what we know, what everyone's saying with the news, with the experts, it was most likely a construction accident. They're already doing work on it. And
I'm not convinced yet.
I'm not either, but that's – and plus there's two terrorist groups roaming around France now. You have the – like, you know, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, that group. And then you also have the Yellow Vests. The Yellow Vests protesters, I think a lot of them are good people, and I sympathize with them because France has kind of become a pretty just, you know, forget everyone else, only the rich kind of system, which I'm against. I want free market capitalism. France isn't like that. Especially their tax code and different stuff. It really just seems like it's just pro-rich.
Have you been able to travel yet to any of these countries, like European countries, and see, you know, a, quote, democratic socialist, you know, country and see what's going on there?
Well, I'm going to Italy next year.
Okay.
Just to visit and stuff, travel around and stuff.
Yeah, be curious.
And I might
here.
Go to we Ireland should... after that.
Call us from Italy. Call us from Ireland.
I don't know.
Be curious
yeah.
to... Curious to see what you think of that. In fact, I'm actually working on some international reporters right now.
Oh,
but before we get, you know, like I say, we got to, I don't even turn on the news. I've never done this before. I turn on the news. I can't play the news on my show just because because it's all copyright stuff. So I'm going to see what's going on.
Yeah.
But I want to get this press conference. So what do you think? Let me just turn the I guess they're waiting for. I can watch. I'll be like the big guys. I'll have my computer screen going so I can watch the, you know, the presentation.
Yeah, I'm going to record it.
Coming on. Oh, there you go. So what do you, like I say, as far as the country goes, as far as the future goes, you know, with this whole Mueller report, with the Democrats and Republicans opposing each other on what appears to me to be nothing. In fact, the president's there. He's going to be watching this, too. This is going to be fascinating. What do you, you know, in the 5 minutes before this starts, what do you think is going to happen?
Supposedly he's revealing the redacted form of the Mueller report. Obviously mm-hmm. doesn't have everything. I strongly do believe that if they released the whole entire Mueller report, then there would be still no grounds for impeachment on Trump. And plus, there is a grand jury investigation or something. I forgot what the actual specific term is. But, I mean, it's still a lot of classified information in there that they legally can't release.
I'm just wondering why they're wasting so much time with it. When you and your friends talking about this
stuff.
Yeah,
that's the exact reason. There's a lot of classified information there that they can't release.
Yeah, but my concern is this is taking up so much time. It's such an incredible waste. But I'm really curious to hear what Bob Barr does. Now, have you ever studied the whole Watergate affair? Did you get that in school?
Yeah, they kind of. I mean, I know what happened. Like, I could tell you what happened. I know what happened.
Okay. All right. The reason I'm wondering is because we get this ideal in school, and you're taught that you know, the executive and the legislative and the judicial, and they all have their equal points, and they do this, that, and the other thing. But what it really comes down to is the fact that there's all this corruption going on. People are trying to influence other people. You've got all these groups, like Michael was talking about with the shareholder meetings. You know, you've got this, you know, as he tries to make a rather dry subject, you know, a lot more interesting. And that's what interests me is the pressure groups. You know, who's saying what? Who's doing what? Who's influencing behind the scenes? Because those are the things that make life interesting. And so now we've got an FBI. See, in Nixon's time, they had a bunch of burglars basically break into Democrat national headquarters. And I think they wanted to spy on them. They wanted to bug something or other. They wanted to find out, you know, what they were doing. But the problem is, it's not that hard to find out what they're doing. And if they wanted to find out what Trump was doing, listen to his speeches. He's pretty open. So the people that are, you know, they think there's somehow this secret hidden stuff going on. And so I come to the conclusion that anybody who's spying on somebody else probably has something to hide themselves, because they think that other people are as nasty and dastardly as they are hiding stuff. So there must be other stuff that the other people are hiding on them. And that's what they're trying to find out. How's that for a theory?
Yeah. Well, I think, the Obama administration, I do believe, is very corrupt. So, I definitely agree with you on that. Yeah.
Do you think the president was behind President Obama was behind spying on Trump?
He probably knew. I would assume that he knew about it.
Do you think he approved?
Well, if he knew about it, and I mean, they were doing it. The thing is that was it just some lone wolves in the FBI that just hated Trump and no regard for the law? And that's not everyone. So they do need to investigate that to see what was going on. In my opinion.
Do you think they would have done what they did without Obama's approval?
Possibly, because, I mean, if they're doing it anyways, they obviously have no regard for the law. So,
okay.
Even if
so,
possible.
If they were operating in a way that would have, you know, overthrown the Trump presidency using the 25th Amendment, declaring the president incompetent, and they didn't tell President Obama, and he found out about it, and he was disgusted by that. What do you think, would have happened to those people?
That's true. Yeah, that's true, actually. Barack Obama probably would have done something if he figured out, like if they did it behind his back. So, I don't know. It's just pure speculation.
It's all speculation. Like I say, I'm looking at the podium now waiting for Bill Barr to come on.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, though, and this is the thing that I don't think people have really talked about. You know, if they thought that Obama was not going to approve of it. Wouldn't that be risking their jobs and their careers and arrest, you know, having a coup attempt go on within the FBI to try and overthrow the president and spy on him, knowing that if their boss found out, they'd all get fired or arrested or worse? Doesn't that mean in some way that Obama – they had to think that Obama did approve of it because that's the only way they could go ahead and think that they would not be arrested or fired or lose their pension or everything else? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense, yeah.
See what I'm getting to? All right, this is where it gets interesting. Yeah, 1 minute to go. I'm still watching. This is going to be a great one. All right, so like I said, the reason the program's a little bit shorter today is because I really want to get into this thing, because here's what I think is going to happen. All right, Jeff Sessions was picked because he's a swamp rat, because he was not going to do anything controversial. He was not going to investigate the Mueller Commission, which is the cover-up of what really happened between the collusion between Hillary and Obama and getting rid of our uranium and selling uranium to the Soviet Union, 20% of our uranium, and the Soviet Russia. And then Russia bribed, you know, the Clinton Foundation for all kinds of information on who knows what they wanted. And anyway, all this stuff's going back and forth and trading back and forth, and it's fascinating what all is happening. And Sessions wouldn't look into it. He recused himself. And so we had this fake Mueller, you know, commission for 2 years, knowing full well that nothing was there. Okay, so he has never justified this as happening. He's never said that, that he had any reason to investigate this. He's never even produced any evidence. So I call this the greatest report on nothing in American history. And so that's how I'm characterizing the Mueller report. And so I'm watching the as we speak, you know, the motorcade, you know, Bill Barr's. Are you watching this as well? Yeah. So Bill Barr's I've never done this. I've never done a live broadcast from a TV show. This is kind of fun. President's walking out of an airplane. I think he's leaving. I guess he's not going to do a press conference. Maybe that's a different feed. Oh, yeah, they're just showing general pictures. Anyway, so everybody's gathering. I think this is really exciting. I think it's kind of fun. So here you are, Dave, live with me, waiting for – this is just like real newscast, for Bill Barr to come take the podium and see what's going on. This is so much fun. This is one of those great moments in history. And, again, so you're going to record it live. You're going to – now, what you have a little bit of a new show of your own. What's going on with that?
I just kind of put it on pause. I need to catch up in a little bit of schoolwork stuff, other personal stuff going on. But I'm going to start making videos again real soon.
Okay. All right. There's something you might want to read. There's a great article I wanted to get to by Andrew McCarthy called Behind the Obama Administration's Shady Plan to Spy on the Trump Campaign. It's something else I would have gotten to probably tomorrow, except that I'm taking off. It's on Action Radio with Greg Penglis. It's on the website. And so I'm just going to start it off here and see what you think. In Senate testimony last week, Attorney General William Barr used the word spying to refer to the Obama administration. He says, spying on the Trump campaign. And Andrew McCarthy says, of course, fainting spells ensued with the media Democrat complex and meltdown. He says, let's even go on this thing. Less than a year ago, we learned the Obama administration had used a confidential informant, a spy, to approach at least three Trump campaign officials in the months leading up to the 2016 election, straining to find proof that the campaign was complicit in the Kremlin's hacking of Democrat emails. So here's the other thing we don't know. We don't know what happened with all those emails that the Russians got. There's just so much that we don't know about this. But let me give you just one overall general question as we're kind of vamping here before Barr takes the podium. What do you think of the state of journalism? Do you see question. What do you think of the state of journalism today?
The fake news is the enemy of the people. I believe Trump really said that. I don't know why they always attack him for saying that. It's very true, because he wasn't saying that the press in and of itself isn't the enemy of the people. It's the fake news press, which I would say grand majority of the press is the enemy of the people.
So what should we do about it?
There's a couple of good news. One American news I really like, even though they're still – because there really doesn't really seem to be any, like, actual news. It's either liberal bias or conservative bias. So I agree with the conservative viewpoint more, but there's no actual flat-out news I can find anymore.
That's interesting. You're right. Everything – well, I think news always had a bias to it. You look at some of the, in years past. There he is. He's coming up to the podium. I'll tell you what. Yep. We're going to shut down the show. I'm going to watch this. I'm going to report on this when I come back next week. Dave, thank you very much.
Sure.
It's been fun. We'll talk to you later. Yeah, there we go. Good. Greg Panos here for Action Radio. I'm going to we're going to listen to this press conference. This is a moment in history, and I'll be back next Thursday.